Good evening.
Evening.
We've been enjoying a little monsoon season over the past week. I think it was just a week ago today that gave us a leaky roof and no place to meet. So it's nice to gather after the monsoon season, come together for a talk, which is kind of what they did in the old days of the Buddha. The monsoons came, they went up into the forests, and then when the monsoons ended, they came back together as communities. So here we are, living the ancient way, right here in our modern city. What's on my mind tonight? What I'm calling it tonight, it's been on my mind for a little bit, is seeing it as the ongoing translation project of, well, it has various aspects you could call it. You know, this ancient practice, this ancient way of making it relevant and modern, you know, bringing it into our lives, our modern lives, and making it relevant. That's kind of the our task. And I think whenever Buddhism and Zen has come to other cultures and times, the task has been to figure out, well, what's relevant and what was belonging to the previous culture and time, and let us discover how to let go of what doesn't serve us because it's outdated. And then not let go of that which can still apply, yeah? So that's one of the translation projects is, you know, if you've been in part of our community for years, you've known how sutras have been updated and languages have been moved into English more. The bowing has changed and all of that. Then there's the translation of, on an individual level, of making sure you embrace the practice and let it become your own without making it just serve you. Yeah. Not picking it apart to just find out what's going to help me, what's going to serve me, what's going to benefit me. That's going too far. But if you don't embrace it at all, you leave it outside as something that's not relevant to your individual life, that's not helpful either. So that's an ongoing translation as well. Kind of the larger translation project I just spoke of, that's on a smaller scale. So how to give yourself to the practice without losing yourself completely, and how to bring the practice to yourself without letting that be the dominant, without making it a self-help project. Yeah. And then there's the translation of something I've experienced, and know talking with others, you've experienced it as well, is trying to explain to people who don't practice this what this practice is about. And they ask, why do you do it? What do you do? And you are at a loss of words, and you don't know how to explain, and it doesn't make sense, and you feel like you're failing. I feel like, oh, if I can't say what, when I hear it, I'm embracing this practice in my life all the time, and I can't explain it adequately to someone, I've got to work on that translation project. Yeah, it's a common thing. And it's a worthwhile thing to look into. I think that's mainly what I've been thinking of late. So those people who come and ask those questions want to know, why do you practice? What's relevant? That's really helpful for them to do. It allows me and each of us to look at it and wonder, well, what is it I'm up to? And also wonder, how can I present this and express this in a way that is meaningful and understandable by somebody who's an outsider, so to speak. I think the easiest route is just to say, instead of trying to get too technical, just say, it helps me find a place of calm. You know, just talk about how it actually helps you. Yeah. Then they'll probably still press and want to know how, what exactly is going on, this and that. And then there's that task of, well, how do I give words to this? In my own experience, I find that when I've been doing this for some time and immersed in this way of being and thinking so much, and likely similar for many of you, that I forget that it looks weird to other people. It doesn't look weird to me. It's just what I know. And so I'll say the thing that makes sense to me and get that weird look back like, huh? What are you talking about? So I forget, oh yeah, this is weird if you're not immersed in it. So how to unweird it, how to bring words to it. Yeah, how to become aware of how this is kind of different in many ways than the mainstream culture of which we're a part. So on that edge of looking at how to unweird it, how to bring something and find a way to connect it to something that people understand, I found there's a line also that I'm not willing to cross, which is to water it down too much for the sake of making it understandable. I've done that a few times, and it leaves a bad taste in my mouth because the other person understood it from their point of view because it made sense to what they knew, but it kind of betrayed, so to speak, the actual thing in the practice because it was watered down and shifted into something else. So I'm, paying attention to what are some of the features of this practice that are that need to be like stated to this point and stopped right here, and invite the other to leave their comfort zone of understanding and come across and come into the weirdness, to reach out and understand beyond what they understand. Yeah? Does that make sense? So one of those things that... I'm going to talk about one key aspect of this practice that I think is really important when not to dilute or water down. And it came about through an experience of talking with somebody that I know. We had recently been on an interfaith panel. We'd done that several times. And on that interfaith panel, often, probably every time, the question of morality arises. Where does morality come from in each of these traditions? On this panel, I'm usually the only one from an Eastern tradition. There's others that are Middle Eastern, most are Western, whether they're religious or secular humanist, atheist, whatever they call themselves. And so trying to present my responses can be baffling because it doesn't fit with what everybody else... It's like everybody else on the panel has a common understanding and they're just debating who's right or wrong. And I find that, I'm coming from a totally different ground than that, and it's hard to... I can't debate you right or wrong because I'm not interested in that. And trying to stick to my ground and not dilute that. It became apparent in that last exchange in the panel. So my friend and I were talking afterwards. And so he was asking me about, from my tradition, what's your morality? And, the scenario he presented was, if I... was walking down the street and then I saw somebody pull up in a van, jump out and grab a child and abduct them. Would I respond to help? I was like, I think so. Yes, I hope so. I was like, that's all theoretical, blah, 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 blah. But I would think I would go, it looks like a child's being abducted, I'd do something to intervene. And then he says, why? Wanting to get me to say because it's the right thing to do. But I found that I could not say because it's the right thing to do. And it wasn't that I didn't want to. I was really looking at the situation. And what I kept saying to him again and again is because it's what's needed in that moment. It's responding to what's happening. It's not about me doing the right thing. It's more about meeting the circumstances and responding. And that frustrated him. So he brought up other scenarios and wanted to get me to say, because it's the right thing to do. And it's like, I can't say that it's the right thing. I don't know that it's the right thing. In other, I think of, they have those television, the sitcoms, or some show where somebody's being chased down the street, and the Good Samaritan jumps in and trips the person who's chasing the other person, thinks they did a good deed, and let the young woman or young man, whoever it was, go and be safe. Turns out the person they tripped was a plainclothes police officer, and they really messed it up. Was it the right thing to do? Well, the circumstances seem to say, stop, somebody's being chased. Did it help the situation? Well, depends on your perspective, I guess. But it's that kind of thing is, I don't really know all the variables of what's going on. I mean, I would like to think it would be clear if a child's being abducted, that's what's happening, but who knows, you know? So leaving those details aside, I just noticed I couldn't say with any, I still can't say it because I'm doing the right thing. So we kind of had that impasse of he couldn't understand why I couldn't say it's the right thing, and I couldn't understand it either at that moment. A few days went by, and I opened up a book by David Hinton and reading where he talks about what he calls the landscape practice of Chan and Taoism and Zen. What I call it is that it's an ecocentric practice rather than an egocentric practice. The ecology, the landscape, the interrelation of things, that's what's central to this practice, is how things are in harmony or not, right? How we relate to one another, how we relate to the 10,000 things, as it's said in our older cultures, meaning everything. They just stopped at 10,000, meaning everything. And it's like, well, that's the key misunderstanding here, is because his tradition comes from more of an egocentric, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, but it's more focused on the me. And, you know, in the Western, I don't know if even, well, part of it is the Western versus Eastern, or maybe just the Western, we have a rational mind. We are the higher beings. Because we can have opposable thumbs and we can do all this stuff, we are the superior. You know, that idea, right? And so right or wrong is really a human concept. And so if I'm operating out of right or wrong, I'm just focused on the human species and neglecting the other 9,999 things, right? So that was the fundamental difference that we haven't had a chance to talk and see if that helps clear things up for him, but it helped me a lot to realize, oh, that's what's important. That's the key thing is this practice isn't about me figuring out what's right. It's about me doing what's needed and supporting the interaction and the weave of everything together. So there's this favorite quote I have. It was on a retreat we had years ago with Joan. It was posted on the wall. She had these little sayings posted on the wall, and this is the one that I ripped off and took home at the end. We were allowed to, so I didn't steal it. Or maybe I did. But she said, hey, take any sayings you want. So I took it, and I couldn't find my copy, so I looked it up. It's by Mencius, who says, the 10,000 things are there in me. There's two different translations. One says here, one says there. I like that, to say it that way. The 10,000 things are there in me. I like that, yeah? It hardly starts to flip things around. And there's no joy greater than looking within and finding myself faithful to them. Yeah? So acknowledging the 10,000 things, all of existence is there, and it's in me. And what a joy to look within, look at the work that I'm doing, look at my place, and know that by inhabiting my place, doing what I do as fully as possible, I'm being faithful to all of existence. Yeah. So how do we do that? How do we not place ourselves above all other things because of our rational mind and our abilities and our, you know, we don't take dominion over all, without reducing and negating what we are? How do we find our proper place? Yeah. And to me, that's just to fully own up to being human. To own up to the fact that, yes, we have a rational mind. Yes, because of that rational mind, we've created many good things and improved the world. And we're also seeing those improvements to the world as also causing great damage to the world. The Industrial Revolution. The smog and everything. Oh, this is great. Look how much we're getting done. And now, oh my gosh, what have we done to the planet? Well, let's use that same mind that created that initial device to create a new device to combat the initial device. So we do something great again to combat what we created before, and then we create something new to combat in the future. To acknowledge that we do that on a large scale and also on a small scale, individually, each of us. So, yeah, it's really to own up to all of our strengths and all of our flaws. And to let ourselves be held accountable by ourselves. And also by inhabiting that even ground with the 10,000 things, letting them reflect back to us how we are affecting them. And affecting the larger ecosystem of which we are a part. So we don't have to deny our humanity. Sometimes a spiritual practice can take on that flavor, and that might be what the human brings to it, is I'm going to get in this practice because I need to get over myself. I need to fix myself. I need to be a better this and that. Or I need to transcend this world and transcend my humanity and kind of just get above and beyond it all. I'd say the way is the opposite. It's go fully into who you are. The word that came to mind, I didn't think it was going to come out tonight, but it is, to realize that we are flawsome. Flaws. Our flaws are awesome. We are flawsome. tongue in cheek. But that, you know, our hindrances, our problems, our shortcomings aren't actually a problem. They're just part of what it is to be who we are. And by owning those fully, with an active acceptance is what I call it. Not just say, no, this is who I am, what can I do? It's like, well, this is who I am, and it matters what I do, so let me pay attention to how I am, and who I am, and what I do, with the help of everything else. And try to do better in concert with the 10,000 things. So that opens up another realm, a different 10,000 things realm, and that's our inner ecology, our inner ecosystem. Another phrase that often comes to mind, or quote comes to mind for me often, is from Eric Fromm, who said, basically, human beings are the only animal for whom its own existence is a problem that needs to be solved. Yeah? Pointed out, we seem to be the only creature who's trying to solve our existence because it's a problem. The squirrels and the dogs and the raccoons who broke the branch of our plum tree last night trying to get to the plums. I wish they'd sort out their lives. I didn't like that, but they're not seeing their life as a problem. They're just going for the plums and smacking to the ground however hard they did. That's the only solace I take. I like that plum tree, and I was like, wow, you broke it. Well, at least you met the ground the way you did, whatever. But, you know, when you look at the birds, look at trees and rocks, nothing out there is trying to solve its existence, but we are. So we can take that to mean that that's a problem. It's a problem that we see our lives as a problem, so we need to fix that problem. Yeah. This is an opportunity to just own that. To be human means I try to solve my existence. Before I can just fully own that, I might have the story that because once I solve my existence, then I will And then fill in the blank with whatever you want. Then I can just, things will be settled and at peace. I won't have to do it anymore. Well, if you stop trying to solve your existence, then you're not being human anymore. So you must continue to try to solve your existence without it actually being a problem. Just being, oh, that's what I do. Yeah. So, you know, fish, the salmon swim upstream around this time of year to spawn and die in the mouth of a bear in the rivers. And the crows gather in the trees and caw. The butterflies flit around. Humans fret and worry. That's fun. That's what we do. You don't need to solve that. Yeah? That's our work, is to engage in being human. Looking at ourselves, trying to improve ourselves. And when we do that fully, we are serving all of existence. Yeah? This kind of relates to Sarah's talk recently, when she was talking about delusion, building off of David Weinstein's comment about becoming a connoisseur of delusion. Which didn't mean enjoying it, but just getting to know it really well. So we have this inner ecosystem, our 10,000 ways of being. Our joys, our sorrows, our delusions, our wisdoms, our shortcomings, our grand offerings, all those existing within us. And our job is to become aware of them, to work with them. And not to, just in the same way, like in the outer world, not to elevate ourselves or get rid of ourselves, you know, get rid of our humanity. Inside, we don't need to elevate certain qualities and get rid of other qualities. We just need to find out, how do we bring harmony to these without having to exclude anything at all? I was thinking about, you know, healthy cholesterol, or it's good to have you need to have bacteria within you to help your system function. So we need a healthy therapeutic dose of delusion. We need that in order to be fully human, and to honor our inner ecosystem. And we need to not get too toxic with our wisdom. A toxic dose of wisdom. Ah, yeah. So working on all those things within is also how we remain faithful to the 10,000 things without. So this phrase flips around for me. The 10,000 things are all here in me, I'll say this time. And there is no joy greater than looking outward and finding myself faithful to them. Yeah? So when I'm embracing what I have within me and going through the turmoil or whatever, embodying and being fully human, trying to solve my existence. If I look out to the 10,000 things among me, I might see that I'm helping keep everything in harmony by embodying my place fully. Yeah. Not because it's right, not because it's wrong, just because I am, and this is what I do. So then we lose that boundary between inner and outer of the 10,000 things. And it's just, you know, the work we engage in this practice of fully being who we are. Looking within in meditation, and then going out in the world and paying attention to how we affect it. We're always crossing between those two realms, those not two realms. Our precepts that we take up, which are about ethics and engaging in the world with the world and trying to benefit it. For those who have studied them, you know they don't make it easy and clear cut. And several of them leave wiggle room. Yeah? First of all, they're all in the negative, like we pointed out. So none of them say, this is what you should do. They kind of say, if you don't do this, things will be easier. So don't kill, don't lie, don't steal. But you have to figure out what to do. Nobody can tell you that from the past, or even completely. You can't tell yourself that based on your own experience. completely because the ecosystem keeps changing. You have to keep responding. So taking up the precepts is a way of relating to the world. And entering with the question of what do I do? Yeah. So back to the other point of there are some precepts that leave wiggle room. I vow not to misuse drugs or misuse sex. It doesn't say no drugs, no sex. It's like, just don't misuse them. Well, what does that mean? Good luck. Or I vow not to gossip maliciously. It's like, oh, malicious. So I can gossip, just not with ill intent. Really? Let me look at that. Yeah, look at that. Or I vow not to indulge in anger. It doesn't say don't be angry. Just don't indulge in it. But maybe you need that therapeutic level of anger to be around. Don't let it become toxic by indulging in it. But keep it around because it helps bring balance to the ecosystem within. So yeah, our practice is about that. Inwardly, outwardly, flowing. And how do we stay faithful to the 10,000 things all around us? Yeah. All within us. That's why there's that frustrating component, I think, where you might come to a teacher such as me or Sarah or somebody, and we have this problem, and so how should I address this? I don't know. But you notice it's there. That's important. And asking the question, what do I do about this, is important. And maybe that's all that's needed. I don't have a recipe. The practice doesn't have, this is the method to deal with these things. Other than notice it's there and inquire into it. Just be curious, what is this? Is one of the responses. Or to look at that thing that you want to get rid of maybe so much, and we say to ask, how can I help? To look at your delusion and ask it, how can I help? That's kind of, again, that's a weird thing. Doesn't maybe seem as weird within this scope of practice, this community, but out there in other realms of the world, when you say such a thing as, how can I be helpful to my delusion? They think, you've got a lot of delusion. You got a lot of work to do. But not so. So just trying to bring in some of those examples of the ways that we, that ecocentric view, ecocentric approach is just embedded in our practice. Yeah. By the actual practice of meditation, by precepts and engaging in the world and paying attention to how you affect others, to the advice you may get from others or come to on your own about how to deal with things, it's just to meet them and be aware that they're there and then have your conversation and move forward. Yeah. You might, you know, carry that around with you a little bit. When you notice you're wanting to grab onto something and fix it and plucking it out of the environment, just focusing in on it too much, if you notice that, you might ask, how can I support the ecosystem here? Inwardly, outwardly. How can I fully embody my place? And be faithful to the 10,000 things. Yeah. So, thanks.